Photography. Exploration. Filmmaking. Conservation. Wildlife. Take a deep breath. You're in the Hydrophone with Jorge Cervera Hauser.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Hydrophone. Today, we have a very special guest. We have Roger Mons here with us. Roger has quite a resume, and he's right now the go-to guy for complex, large-budget natural history documentaries that include underwater filming. Emmy and BAFTA-winning cinematographer, Roger has worked for major productions such as BBC Life, Life Story, Life in Cold Blood, I think pretty much everything, all of the BBC productions that have Life on the title, as well as stuff like Blue Planet 2. Welcome, Roger. Happy to have you with us.
Hey, Jorge. How are you doing? Thank you so much for having me on, man. Really, really glad to be here.
Me too. I'm okay. I'm all right. Surviving COVID.
Yeah. Are you back in the water yet?
I'm having a blast. I'm going on my boat. I'm using my dirt bike a lot. Business-wise, not so much. Back to the interview. So I first met Roger a little over 5 years ago in San Ignacio Lagoon, trying to film the birth of a gray whale for the first time ever. It was somehow a very strange production for Hungary's public television. We were not successful, but it sure was fun. And what's the thing you remember the most about that? It was almost a month, right? Or at least 3 weeks.
That was a long shoot, yeah. You know, the thing, it's funny because it was such an amazing experience. And San Ignacio was stunning. I mean, you know, the beautiful starry nights, the sound of whales blowing all night long, you know, that lagoon right by where we were staying, it was beautiful. But the thing that really stays with me, that I remember from that trip, is the drive home with you, singing Kenny Rogers and The Gambler. That's like, if I have one overriding memory, it's that like 12-hour drive with your playlist in the car, just rocking it out, man. That was so much fun. That was so much fun.
It was a super fun drive. And just so you know, as of today, every time I go out on my boat, the very first song that has to play on the boat as we leave the marina is The Gambler.
Ah, beautiful. Oh. I'm giving you a virtual fist bump, man.
Here we go.
It was such an unusual shoot, but I have such great fond memories from it. And I still remember, even though the visibility was obviously very bad, that one calf that we had, it was sort of being lifted, you know, we probably missed the birth by minutes, I think.
Yes.
And it was like lifting it up to help it breathe, and we were filming it from the surface. I mean, that was a pretty special occasion for me. I'd never seen anything like that.
It was really special, and I agree. It was not like any other shoot. It was more of like a couple's vacation, and they had us along for the ride or something. But it was really fun. And
yeah. And I got to meet you, man. Yeah, and we, you know, we made friends, lifelong friends with yourself and Johan. Yeah, it was really special.
Yeah, good friendships came out of it. So speaking of real natural history shoots, and before we dive into the guts of the interview, I'm going to ask a very simple question that doesn't really have a simple answer, but I'm sure everybody listening wants to know, how does one become like the main underwater camera guy for the BBC? And of course, there's no formula to it, but it would be really interesting to get to know your journey to get there, to position yourself like the one of the top underwater cameramen out there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a very tricky answer, and it's a question that, you know, I do get quite often, because my job is perceived as quite a, you know, a lifestyle job, and a lot of people aspire to it. I just want to clarify that obviously, I think the BBC are one of my main clients, and I'm very fortunate to work for them. But, you know, obviously there are like other cameramen that work regularly for the BBC that, you know, there are a few of us out there. So I'm not the guy. I've had some great colleagues and people in this business. But yeah, it's a difficult one. I think talking to other camera operators who do similar work to me, everyone has had a different path. So some guys have gone, what I would say is the more traditional path is where you become a good diver and then you put yourself about a bit and you get work as a camera assistant. And that historically was pretty much the only way to do it. So back in the 80s and 90s, that kind of was the role. You became a camera assistant, you helped out, you were a dog's body, you cleaned lenses, you know, and then you kind of learned from the guy you were working with. And then you started taking jobs after that. After a few years, you started getting your own work and you went your own way. That's less common now because most shoots can't afford a camera assistant, you know? So even at the high end, you don't have that regular camera assistant position. I got into diving first, a love of diving. And I think underwater cameramen, as opposed to topside camera operators, most of us come from like a wildlife diving background. We just love diving. We discover diving, get a love for it. And then we want to marry the photography or the videography with the diving, you know? And I think you need that strong diving background because you need to understand your subject and you need to be a very confident and experienced diver before you pick up a camera. I think that's kind of an issue these days because people pick up a camera on their open water course, you know, and it's like, slow down, learn to be a good diver first, learn to take care of yourself and others, and then get into the camera work. I think where a lot of people perhaps stumble or hit a roadblock in their career path is they have a camera, they're doing productions, they're working on maybe low budget stuff, or maybe stuff for social media, and they want to take that step to working on, say, natural history, you know, kind of landmark natural history stuff for the BBC or Netflix or whatever. And I think that's where there is a bit of a roadblock, and it's hard to take that step. And what I'd say to those people is I see a lot of showreels, a lot of guys contact me and girls and say, can take a look at my showreel, see what you think. And generally my feedback is great. Beautiful images, you know, maybe there's some whales or maybe there's even some great bit of behavior. But what producers want to see is story. So they want to see that you can shoot a story. Yes, they can appreciate a beautiful image, but there's a lot of people out there that can get that. But when they hire a cameraman, they want to know they can trust you to deliver a story that you could pretty much cut, edit together. You wouldn't even need narration, you know, just the shots would tell the story. That's what they need from a sequence cameraman, from a natural history cameraman. So I would say to those guys out there, you know, you don't have to be out filming mantas or whale sharks or humpback whales every day. But if you want to put together a good showreel, go and find something. It can be a cuttlefish or a turtle or something. You know, it can be something pretty mundane, but try and film a story, a sequence. Get all the shot sizes you need. Get things leaving and entering frame and build. Show a 2 or 3 minute story. And then when you go and see a producer and you say, please hire me, show them that. And I think they're more likely, you know, to do that.
And that's actually an entirely different question I have down the road. When do you think it was your break while getting into this business? Because I think everyone has that one project that made a big difference in becoming who you are today. What was yours?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think a lot of people do have that tipping point, that break. For me, I had like a couple of almost false starts. But I worked with the first Attenborough program I worked on was, as you mentioned earlier, my kind of life sort of area. It was Life in Cold Blood. And that was the first time I'd filmed on an Attenborough production, what I would consider like landmark BBC blue chip, we call it. And I filmed a mating turtle sequence. So that came about because I'd worked for the producer of that episode. I'd worked for him previously on a children's TV series. And then he moved on to doing Blue Chip. And he contacted me and said, hey, I've got an idea. I'd like to do the mating turtles. I know that's in your neck of the woods. And he trusted me to have a go at it. It was fairly low risk. So it wasn't a big risk for him. And then, yeah, doing that, getting that first natural history sequence was amazing. But it wasn't like the work flooded in afterwards, you know, it wasn't like suddenly everyone was contacting me. So then we did the humpback whale heat run for Life. And that was a big one because it was the first time it had been filmed about 10 years ago. it was pretty dangerous. With I was featured in the making of, so that felt like a bit of a tipping point. But again, it wasn't like I could sit back and you know, let the work roll in. I still had to fight for work, market myself, try and put myself out there. I guess really what Blue Planet was probably the big one. Once, you know, working on that series, which was such an honor, having loved the original, that after working on that, then it's become easier for me to find work, I would say, because it was such a global series. Everyone recognizes it, and I did such a sort of large body of work on it, shooting 10 sequences. So I guess if there was a true breakthrough, maybe that was it. But there have kind of been little steps along the way, you know.
That's nice. And it's funny that you mentioned the humpback whales, because my next question was about you were leading the camera crew that captured on film for the first time the humpback hedron off Tonga. And that pretty much translates into mating chaos. Multiple males competing for a female in a wildebeest style stampede. What's it like to jump into a high-speed highway packed with 50-ton whales coming straight at you? And what was the biggest challenge of that shoot?
Yeah, that was an incredible shoot. And I think these days people have done it since, but then the biggest fear and the biggest problem there was the unknown, because it hadn't been done. And you see it at the surface. So again, just to reiterate what it is, so you have one female who's on heat, and then 10, 50-ton humpback males chasing the female. And basically she is whittling down, trying to get the best genes, the strongest male. So it's a test of strength. She swims at full pelt. They chase her. And as they get tired, they peel off until there is one remaining. And it's obvious, and it's a dirty fight as well. So they'll be slapping each other, blowing bubbles in each other's faces, trying to put each other off. It's kind of Death Race 2000 with whales. So seeing that, knowing what it was, seeing the frothing and slapping at the surface, and then jumping into it, having no idea what was going to happen, was, I'm not going to say it was terrifying, but you know, it was worrying, and we just didn't know what to expect. And the fear was probably not so much that a whale would have intent to hurt you, because you know, as you know, cetaceans, well, I don't think that's their game. But that they'd be so intent on what they were doing, on the female, so horny, so like, got to catch that female, that they would just not notice me. And, you know, I'd get a fluke slap, be knocked unconscious, or, you know, so that was the worry for me. And I wasn't going to know until I jumped in the water. So sitting on the back deck, as the skipper's shouting, go, 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 jumping in, the adrenaline's pumping. But as you know, Jorge, when you're working in photography or video, you've got to, part of the business is learning to control that adrenaline, push it down, stay calm, and remain calm. That's a big part of the fight. Remain calm, focus on. I have like a little mantra. I'm just like, focus, exposure, hold it steady, focus, exposure. You know, and I'm just like trying to focus on that, detach myself from the reality of the situation. I think that's what you have to do. And in some, I think it's a little bit dangerous actually, because you put yourself in a situation where maybe if you didn't have the camera between you and the animals, maybe you wouldn't be there. But you have that sense of detachment. You're looking at it through a monitor. You're trying to stay calm. And that's what I was doing. But yeah, the big fear was being smacked, getting a fluke or a fin or something. And luckily, they were so sensitive that in fact, it turned out to be the opposite. And you know, you had to be super stealthy and quiet. Otherwise, they would dive down. So you had to be thin, gently, all the usual stuff you do with cetaceans, and it was a very similar situation. But I'm not saying it wasn't dangerous. There was one time where I was sort of out of breath, and a huge humpback came straight over my head between me and the surface. You know, after 30 seconds, where I'm gasping already, pushing a big camera 10 meters. That was pretty terrifying.
So you shot the entire sequence freediving?
Yes, because yeah, scuba wasn't allowed in Tonga, and at that time, rebreathers were still not commonly used in natural history filmmaking, not so much as they are now.
Whenever I'm in the open ocean looking for pelagics, that's the way I like to do it. You have more freedom to move, you're stealthier, but yeah, of course, if you're running out of air and there's a humpback crossing right on top of you, that's not the ideal situation to be in. But that's what
I love free diving, and I consider, I'm not snobbish about any of these things. The way I see it is we have tools in our toolbox. You know, there's scuba, there's free diving, and there's rebreather. And it's a case of choosing the right tool for the job, you know, each time. And I'm not snobbish about using scuba. I think it's great, it's easy, it's reliable, put a small pony on, but yeah, maybe it's gonna scare the whale, so you can't use it, or you know, I think you just have to select the right tool, really.
With video as well,
we need steady shots, so it's like, you know, it's nice to have to be able to suck some air down and hold it steady.
For sure. And going back to the story, again, we know you work for not only for the BBC, but I like to focus on the BBC because I love their documentaries, and they're always on the front line of capturing never before seen animal behavior. And that gets more and more difficult because you guys are so successful at it that you just keep raising the bar. And not only that, the BBC documentaries always do it with a unique suspense and storytelling that only you can achieve. For example, in Blue Planet 2, you captured Percy the Tusk Fish using a coral to smash a clam open so he could eat it. A bunch of clownfish moving a coconut around to make themselves a nursery. And then the infamous Jay Leno fish going through sex change surgery. And I don't think, and maybe I'm wrong, but at least me, I don't think before Blue Planet 2, we even knew that fish were capable of using tools. I knew that octopuses use tools, and extremely smart animals like chimpanzees and maybe dolphins, but fish, and that was something really, really interesting. How on earth do you find these behaviors, and how do you know, or the people behind the research department know how to find them and where to start looking?
Yeah, well, I think, like, you've hit the nail on the head for me. I think what sets the BBC apart, there are a few things, but the BBC's natural history programming, a lot of what sets them apart is they're kind of focused on character-led stories and they're like new science. So I think it's a big thing, you know, they're always trying to show new behavior, something new. And most of that comes from like good, hard research. So, you know, each program in one of these series might have 6 or 8 episodes. Each episode has a producer, an assistant producer, and a researcher. And you might even have a global researcher who covers the whole series as well. And you're doing like, I think they're doing six months of research before we even start filming. So they're contacting scientists, divers, photographers like yourself, cameramen, fishermen, you know, they're spreading that web out, going through scientific papers, you know, just doing the hard graft to wean out the story. And then you find an interesting behavior, and then you have to work out whether that translates onto the screen. You know, if you can tell it as a compelling story on screen, it might be a great bit of science, but it might not work visually. So then you have to kind of filter those down into something that is going to capture people's imagination, excite them, and is new. So it's an incredibly difficult job, and I think it's a big part of the BBC's success. You know, they're incredible research, and they have the time. So these productions are generally 4 years in length from when they're commissioned to coming out. So there's that pre-shoot period, pre-production, and then all the way through production, you know, they're researching new stories and working out stuff and finding new behaviors. So it's like a constant thing throughout production, really. I think it's, you know, it's the work they put in that really delivers on screen. And, you know, I give so much credit to whatever I capture to that research team and the producers for finding these amazing stories, and they put you there at the right time and make sure we're there when it's going to happen, the best conditions. And that's down to great research and great producing, really.
And actually, you told me that the clownfish thing happened like just a few feet outside of like a bungalow resort or something, right? It was like right there.
that people are literally doing their open water courses like 5 meters away, you know, on their knees doing a reg recovery, you know, and there's these animals which are doing this incredible behavior there, and no one knew about it. Or I had filmed it before until I went down and filmed it. It's just insane. And that's what I love. I love telling stories, especially to the general public, divers, showing them that fish they might feel are inconsequential or not particularly interesting are capable of doing the most amazing things, like Percy, like the little clownfish. Everyone, yeah, it's a cute Nemo. That's all it was known for, but it's charismatic, can problem solve. You know, it can push something 2 or 3 times its weight in that urge to procreate and make babies. That's why I love kind of showing those. The fish that we're not so interested in, while we've all got our heads in the open water looking for whale sharks, you're swimming over these incredible stories. So it's great to get a chance to put those on screen and show people, you know.
And that was a little bit about finding the story. How about once you know what the story is and you're down there filming, you said it yourself before, you're not, obviously it's natural history filmmaking, so you're not in a controlled environment, but also something that makes it super different to even other kind of documentary shootings is that you don't have the director there with you telling you which shots to get. And everything's going to be changing constantly. So how do you go about getting all the shots you know you're going to need to put that, so the people in post can put that story together? Because that's also something the BBC does amazingly well.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the credit to, you know, has to go to the editors as well, who are kind of unsung heroes, I think, who just do an amazing job with our footage. Editing is just magic, really, what some guys can do. So when we're on location, team size can really vary. So I'd say a typical team would be, so myself, cameraman, I'd have a camera assistant or a dive buddy, depending on, there's a lot of grip intensive stuff. You know, if we're setting up tripods, sliders and stuff, then probably a camera assistant. If it's more free shooting, then maybe a dive buddy, a safety diver. And generally one person from production, so either the producer, the assistant producer, or the researcher will come out as kind of a field director. That doesn't always happen. I've done quite a few shoots remotely myself and just a safety diver, but often someone from production comes, and they'll maybe even two, someone to help with the DIT in the evening to download, log the footage, and so on. And that is, so we normally go out, obviously we know the story before we go out. It's been well researched, and depending on the producer, sometimes they will even put together a storyboard, so like a graphic storyboard with how we're going to tell the story. Other times we'll just have a more simple storyboard with text. We've got a very strong idea how we want to tell it, but it obviously, as you said, it doesn't always pan out that way. You know, real life doesn't match how what you imagine. You can do all the research in the world, but you can get there and you're like, oh, okay, this is what it's really like, you know. So there are, like, you know, 5 foot waves crashing over this spot all the time, or, you know, it's never how you imagine. So you have to be adaptable. The fish or the animal might not do what you expect. So you have to adapt on location, but there's a lot of feedback. So I like that. I'm quite collaborative. I like shooting on my own, but I really enjoy having someone from production there. And the evenings, we go through the footage. We say, okay, we like this, we like this. Maybe we can do this better. Maybe we can do a different angle. And it's really nice to have that to and fro, and also to have someone there to challenge you a bit, you know, to say, that's good, but you can do better, you can get tighter, and to pull you out. I don't know about you, but sometimes I get very obsessed and fixated with one shot and I can't get it. So I might be spending like 10 hours trying to get this one shot that actually is not crucial to the thing, but I've got to get that. So they can kind of like reach in, pull you out of that. It's like, it's okay, you've got that, let's come back to that later, let's focus on something else. It's nice to have like a voice of reason as well, so we can get a little bit, you know, tunnel vision as a sort of creative cameraman and photographers, I think. Yeah, so that's really how it goes. And then you generally have like 2 to 3 weeks on location to get what you need depending on the shoot. But when I finish the shoot, I'm never happy, so it's always a real, I think mentally it's interesting that you after 2 or 3 weeks, you're probably, I'm keen to come home and see my family. I'm missing my family. But at the same time, I'm always like, we haven't quite got this good enough, or I want to get this better. So I'm really torn. Like, leaving is always mentally very tough for me. I'm excited to leave, but I'm not generally like a bit down, disappointed almost always. So yeah, there's that tension there all the time, you know, which I find quite interesting as well.
What happens to me a lot when I get fixated on one shot, obviously with me, it's still photography. But when I get super fixated in a shot that I want to get, in the end, when I'm reviewing all the stuff, that one shot turns out, because most of the times I'm so stubborn that I get it. And yeah. Sometimes it's like, okay, this is not what I expected it was going to be. And then something that I didn't even plan and just happened by pure chance turns out to be like the best photo.
The shot. Yeah, so true. Yeah, I think that's why I like to have that someone else there, just to be like, give me a bit of reality, you know, just pull you out a little bit, for sure.
And what's the strangest behavior you've documented?
That is an interesting one. I think, you know, pretty much everything that goes on underwater is strange, but I do think the, so we filmed on the Barrier Reef in Australia for Blue Planet. We filmed this collaborative hunting between grouper and octopus.
I remember that.
And that for me was really interesting to see two completely different species. We've got a cephalopod and a fish working together, and it all kind of hinges on Dr. Alex Vail, who's also a shooter. He wrote a paper on it, and it all hinges on this referential gesture where the octopus is hunting, and then the grouper will perform this headstand and point towards the fish, the prey, and the octopus will recognize that and then hunt. And then maybe he'll grab it and get food, in which case the grouper gets nothing, but maybe he won't and it'll escape. And as it escapes, the grouper smashes in and gets it. So he's supposedly working on the fact that, say, 30, 40% of the time, he'll get some food, you know, and it's easier for him than trying to smash into all the rocks and get at the fish. The octopus flushes them out. But I thought that was like fascinating, the way that the two, you know, if an octopus and a grouper work together, then there's hope for the human race. You know, we can maybe, you know, work together, hopefully. They can't communicate any other way than like gesturing, and they've worked out how to do it, you know, so there is hope for us, hopefully.
I'm not so sure. And another really interesting and really different project you were recently involved in was as principal cameraman to film the underwater screensavers for Apple. And first of all, it blows my mind the level of production and resources a company like Apple can pour only to have pretty images on the screen when nobody's really looking at the screen. And what was it like? How is it different from a natural history shoot working for a big company just trying to get pretty pictures?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It was a really interesting project for me. And the kind of genesis of it was that Apple already had these beautiful kind of aerial screensavers. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to do something different. So they contacted the Natural History Unit, and they commissioned the Natural History Unit to produce about 20 underwater screensavers for them. So I was working with some of the team from Blue Planet on it. Myself and Roger Horrocks from South Africa shot the bulk of them. And it was a really interesting kind of marriage of, I guess, kind of commercial work, art, and natural history filming, kind of elements of those all put together. And in terms of research, it was kind of similar. So research the behavior, try and find things that would look beautiful and fit the look that Apple were after. And we had some really tough, like, technical constraints, because the image has to be always moving, because if you have a static image, then you get burn-in on your TV. So you can't have anything static. So the camera has to be constantly moving, mostly on the Z axis, so forward, and not so interested in X or Y moves. So constant track forward has to be incredibly smooth and stable. And basically, we are trying to match what they're achieving topside with a helicopter, with a gyro stabilized system, with like 7 gyros and a lens that can focus on like a jumping dolphin from 2 kilometers away and keep it stable. Like it's a $500,000 system mounted on a helicopter, and we're trying to match that underwater. So it's incredibly tricky, high frame rate, because they like a very slow feel to it. So it was very technically difficult to identify what was going to work before we went there. And I think the first couple of shoots, what we did was we chose the first shoot at a kind of general reef location where we had a few options. And that way we could kind of hone in on what was working and what wasn't. So it was a kind of a buffet, so shoot a bit of this, shoot a bit of that, try and get some feedback and then kind of hone in on our direction forward. And then we did that. So we did some jackfish, barracuda. We worked out the kind of look that would work. So what we're trying to do is get basically minimum 2-minute shot, completely steady, no bumps or wobbles, and generally like a similar, you don't want a random thing to come in. It has to be kind of uniform. You don't want too much character. So you don't want to be following one animal because that takes you, screensavers are supposed to be relaxing and you don't want your attention to be drawn to something. So it has to be, the phrases we were using were mesmeric and hypnotic. I'm going to lie back. So when afterwards, viewing the rushes after a day, we would sit back, the big screen, watch it. And if there was any moment in which we were sort of like drawn or pulled out of it, we were like, that's no good. That doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? It doesn't work for this reason. Okay, so we were constantly kind of reevaluating what worked and what didn't. But I guess the hardest thing for me was that generally on it was 2 or 3 week shoots, similar to natural history. But generally, as you alluded to earlier, you're chipping away and you're getting shots every day, building your story. But for this, we were after one shot in 3 weeks. There was going to be one win, and that was it. So you ended up repeating shots, the same shot, time after time after time after time, you know, until you were just like broken, trying to get the perfect shot. And there was just going to be one winner. So it was hard. You'd be 2 weeks in and you wouldn't have had anything to show for it. You know, normally you'd have something, some close-ups, but you have absolutely nothing. So it was quite hard mentally. Because you felt like you were, after 2 weeks, sometimes you're still at ground zero and you've achieved absolutely nothing. You know, and then you got it. It was very binary. It was like 0 or 1. And then you got it, 1, and then you're kind of done. You know, so it was really, really fascinating and challenging 6 months for me on the various shoots. Have you seen them? What did you think of them?
Yeah, no, I was going to say that I went through all of them this morning. And all of them are amazing. I love them. And not only did you guys match the beautiful helicopter shots with a gyro stabilizer camera on them, at least the Golden Kaunos rays, for me, it's just way above any of the aerial shoots from Apple. So I was impressed. That was probably my favorite one, the Golden Kaunos rays.
Oh, thanks, man. That's my favorite as well. Yeah, I really like that. I love them as animals. I think just the motion, the flying, you know, I think it works. It works really well. I mean, and that was actually, I was talking to you at that time. Obviously, we were in your neck of the woods. We were actually after the Mobula. And didn't get them, and so it was complete fluke that we found those Kaunos. And to me, I think I love the Mobula, but I think the Kaunos, just the color and the kind of autumn brown texture to them, I think it probably works better than the others would have.
I was going to say that visually, the Golden Kaunos rays are much better than the Mobulas.
Yeah, and so I think that's. That was lucky, you know. We were, because that was a classic shoot where after 2 weeks we had like zero. There'd been a big storm. The Mobula had disappeared. We couldn't find groups of more than 50. It seemed to have just broken up and scattered for some reason. No one could really tell us for sure why. And we were pretty down. And then we had a microlite that managed to spot that group of Kaunos. And it was, oh man, that was a bonus. Yeah, really, really saved us.
Yeah, and I remember back then when you reached out, you you didn't tell me what kind of project it was or who were you working for. And this morning when I saw it, I was like, ding, 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 ding. That was, that was that.
Yeah, there's a lot of, as you know, there's a lot of secrecy on these things, man. Yeah. It can be hard because you're on a shoot for something and it might not come out for 2.5 years, you know. So it's like, you can't talk about it for 2.5 years, 3 years until it comes out. It's so frustrating. You've pretty much forgotten about it by the time it comes out.
Also, Roger, I love this question because most people have somehow a misguided idea of what nature is like. A lot of people think it's like a Disney-like world packed with happy critters singing along their happiness and their joy. And that couldn't be further away from the truth. And I think there's one project that you shot for Nat Geo that's actually called Hostile Planet. And that was, if I'm not wrong, the second time you filmed the sea turtles mating. And everybody, again, going back to this Disney concept of animals, the third time. Okay, it was the third time. So going back to the Disney concept of animals being pretty and nice and all happy, describe us a little bit of what happens when green turtles are mating underwater. How raw and how crude can it get?
Yeah, super violent. It's horrible. Turtles have such an image as, you know, cute, cuddly, sleepy, dopey animals. But if you've had the unfortunate chance to see a turtle mating orgy, I can't really call it anything else, then your perception of turtles changes quite radically. It's, first of all, you'll get one male will attach itself to the female, and then he'll be pretty happy. Grips on with, they've got little claws on their flippers, grip onto the carapace, be riding away, and he'll, you know, try and insert his appendage in. And then the female at that point has to carry about 80 kilos on her back, swimming along, and she has to breathe. If she's relaxed every 30 minutes, but in this situation, swimming hard much more frequently than that. So she has to carry 80 kilos on her back and still manage to get up and breathe. And those, what I liked about the times I filmed that is that we very much focused on the female as the central character. It's a very female-led story. Then what happens is other males get the scent and they'll see what's happening and they will come in and they've tried to dislodge that male. So their weapons are their very sharp beak and their shell and their head. So they will ram into it, try and force themselves. It's the gap between the shells like this, and they will try and get between the shells and try and prise them apart. They will hang on, so they'll bite onto the rear flippers of the male like this, and then just stay there, just like a dog with a bone, just gripping onto the back of it, swinging around, tearing flakes of skin off. I mean, the damage that these guys have to their rear flippers is horrific, and you see some of the old big males have this huge white scarring on the back of their rear flippers, which is awful. And then when a big one occurs, you can get 10 males coming in. And at that point, it's just carnage, you know. Like a few times they've been coming in and they'll chase off other males. So they'll try to catch the male and the female, the couple. And then if another male comes along, they'll turn around and they'll face and chase it off. And they often do that to you. So you'll be following them. Really close. Right up in the face of them, they don't care. And then suddenly one of them will just come up and start chasing you. He's got to like back off, save the dome, get away from there, relax a bit, and then swim back in again. And the whole time they're doing these violent, it's the worst profile ever. They're smashing down to 20 meters, back up to the surface, down to 30 meters, back up again. And you're pedaling at just about as fast as you can. Pedaling, it's like if it was running, it would be like running a 1500 meter. You're at 1500 meter pace all the time, just to stay level with them, you know. And you give yourself a bit of a break and they get away, and you have to sprint a bit to catch up. But just to stay, just to maintain alongside them, you're running this strong 1500 meter pace all the time with your fins, and it can go on for like 4 hours or longer. It's insane.
And sometimes they drown, right?
Yeah, I have once seen seen them just disappear into the depths. You know, I just saw a couple just going down. I followed them down to about 40, and they kept going. And I assumed that they drowned. Like maybe she got back up again. Like maybe the male disengaged, but at that point they were just going down. And that's what I would assume.
Okay, it's time to wrap up the show, but not before we do a little thing I like to call the close encounter trifecta. So you have to tell me your number one wildlife encounter in the following categories: the most awesome, the scariest, and the most moving. And keep it short and sweet. Awesome, scary, moving, go.
Awesome would be, awesome is the heat run. I think jumping in front of 10 humpback whales was like standing on the freeway in front of 10 huge trucks coming towards me. So that was pretty awesome. Moving, I'm going to go humpbacks again. It was like a 2 hour encounter with the playful humpback calf that was about probably a few days old. It was 2 tons, the size of a full grown elephant, but it had the mind of a puppy and it just wanted to play. And that was absolutely beautiful. It was one of the most wonderful experiences I've ever had. What was the third category?
Scary.
Scary. Oh man, I could go heat run again, but I'm gonna go sperm whales. I can't tell you the location because this thing hasn't come out yet. But yeah, being amongst the socializing group of sperm whales, cute, about maybe 10, and just being right in amongst them, 10 whales just rubbing against each other and moving around all around me. And then one of them just comes like with its mouth open, just like soars right into me like that, and then pushing away. It meant no harm. It was just checking me out with its stone, just clacking away. But yeah, at the time it was so deep, and I was like, deep into my monitor. Yeah, amazing and scary.
Nice. Well, Roger, it was a pleasure having you. It's always fun to have a drink with you, even if it's at 10 in the morning over there. Probably you should go to a meeting or something, but it's it's always fun to talk to you. It's always fun to see you, even if it's over a laptop. And thank you everyone for joining in. You can find the Hydrophone on Spotify, on iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe. You can find Roger on Instagram as roger.mons and myself as at JC Hauser. And I'll see you guys next week. Thank you, Roger, for being here and taking the time.
Thank you so much, Jorge. Like you say, man, it's always a pleasure catching up. I feel like we haven't seen each other for so long, but it feels like I saw you yesterday.
This was the Hydrophone with Jorge Cervera Hauser.